Chair paralysis, submitted by Steph.
Hey, Edie, Nick, and Uglies.
Hey.
Thought I would start off with just a little story to begin with. So my partner has TBI, traumatic brain injury, is on a bunch of medication, and is prone to sleep paralysis. If I'm awake, I can pull her out of it. I also get it occasionally if I've been awake too long. I take my sleep medicine, and my body shuts off before my brain. There is this one time I was having sleep paralysis the same time as my partner. In our paralysis state, we both thought we were yelling out to each other for help, but we weren't. Luckily, the cat jumped on her, which pulled her out of her sleep paralysis, and then pulled me out of mine. It was just freaky that we both had sleep paralysis at the same time. It wasn't scary for me, but it was for my partner. Anyone have any ideas as to why we both had it at the exact same time? Anytime we tried to go back to sleep, we went back into sleep paralysis. It was so strange.
All right. Welcome to the True Scary Stories with Edie podcast. And Nick.
Yeah.
This is the podcast where two stand-up comedians read scary stories. We talk about them. If you don't want to hear any talking, then check out our other episodes under Just the Terror, which is all the terror, none of the talk. Mm-hmm. If you want to send your story to us, like Steph did, you can do it on the Facebook group, the Instagram, or on the website, all at True Scary Stories with Edie.
Yep.
All right, Steph, thank you so much for sharing this. It is very weird that you both got sleep paralysis at the same time.
Yeah, I've never heard of people having it at the same time. Were you guys seeing each other in your sleep paralysis? Because then maybe it's like you guys met on a different plane.
Oh, like astral realm.
Yeah, because if they were seeing each other, then yeah, they met somewhere else. But if they were just having sleep paralysis at the same time, you know what I'm saying?
Right. It's like a connection.
Yeah.
Are you guys very connected? Are you very close? Because maybe that's me and Nick, I guess, aren't that connected.
Yeah. And it could be that. It could be that you both experience it at the same time because...
How come you don't get sleep paralysis with me?
What?
How come you don't get sleep paralysis with me? You don't let me...
We don't have... we don't have Steph to soothe us to bed.
Oh, yeah. I either think... It's either Satan, like the biggest, baddest guy,
or a skinwalker.
Maybe... No. Or maybe think about what you guys ate or like what activities you did.
Yeah.
Because if you did them together, then it might have triggered you guys having sleep paralysis. And that would explain why you had it at the same time. It's either Satan. You guys are really, really connected and in love more than most people.
I think that's what it is.
Or you guys ate something or went on a certain trip or exhausted yourselves to a certain extent that you both had it.
I'm going with option B. I think you guys are just very connected. You've had a lot of these moments, so you have shared one moment together.
Right.
I would be worried about the cat. The cat obviously doesn't have these moments, so luckily they saved you, but no, I'm just kidding.
What if he doesn't know the cat didn't have it too?
Oh, yeah, the cat knew.
The cat might have been in there too.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that too, that they're very, very in love, more than most people.
Yeah, it could be that.
Yeah, but I'm going to go with Satan.
Okay.
I think it's the devil himself. All right, thank you, Steph. This story comes from the USC Digital Folklore Archives. Stage 19. Hollywood is the home of many eerie tales, so many that there's a tour called the Haunted Hollywood Tour. A famous stop is the cemetery, which is the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, located directly across the street from Paramount Studios. Security guards who work around the stage at Paramount Studios have claimed that many times those restless spirits and souls in the Hollywood Forever come back to haunt the studio. This happens so frequently that the security guards, more specifically those who work at the night shift, have given the studio a new name. They call it Paranormal Paramount. One of the most famous hauntings is the haunting of Stage 19, the stage where Happy Days was shot. Most security guards refuse to work the night shift on Stage 19. The stage is said to be haunted by Heather O'Rourke, who was a little girl from Poltergeist. She was also joined the cast of Happy Days as Heather Pfizer and was featured in 12 episodes from 1982 to 1983. She died in the hospital in 1988 from mysterious causes. Although it was believed that there was some sort of surgical complication, she was only 12. On one evening, a man was talking to a night shift security guard who worked on Stage 19 about the paranormal activities that go on in that studio. The security guard told the man that almost every night he hears running and laughing on the catwalk above the set, which is where Heather liked to play when she was on the set of Happy Days. The security guard also told the man that sometimes they'd see a little girl playing on the stage. The man asked what they do when they see her. The security guard replied that they usually just tell her to leave and she runs off. The man decided he wanted to test this out for himself. The guard led him into the stage at midnight and bid him good luck before shutting the soundstage door. The man walked around and waited. He prepared himself to hear running on the catwalk or to see Heather playing, but nothing happened. Finally, after 20 minutes or so, he decided to provoke the little spirit a little by asking her to come out and play. Not a second after these words left her mouth did the man feel a hand brush across his lower back. He immediately ran off the stage in terror outside and told the security guard what happened and how he really didn't expect anything was going to happen. The security guard left and told the man that his expression looked just like the one of the editor for the show Wings, which was also shot on stage 19, when he saw Heather in the background of one of the shots.
The Poltergeist Curse.
So, what you guys just heard about the little girl that was kind of haunting Paramount Studios, one of the stars of Poltergeist. In total, on Poltergeist, 4 cast members died during or soon after the filming of the series, which made a lot of people believe that the actual series, the 3 movies, were cursed. The little girl, Heather O'Rourke, died of Crohn's.
That's what I have.
Yeah.
I have Crohn's disease.
And do you think maybe, you know, like, similar to what you faced, they didn't believe her, like, when she was like, my stomach hurts.
Yeah, yeah, because she had to have emergency surgery.
Yeah.
And then they think that something went wrong during the surgery, and that's what led to her death. She was the little girl who got trapped in the TV.
Yeah, Carol Ann. Yeah.
That was the worst, that was the scariest part of that.
Yeah?
Yes, I remember.
I thought the clown was the scariest
part. I don't even remember a clown, but I do remember her getting trapped in the TV. And I remember hearing a legend that they used real human skulls.
Skeletons for the muddy pool scene. So, yeah, so that's where we start to believe that this curse started, was Spielberg apparently wanting to save money, used real skeletons in a scene. So he was bringing in,
dead bodies.
Dead bodies, right? The second person to die was Dominique Dune, who played the eldest daughter, Dana, in the first film. She died on November 4th, 1982, at age 22, after being strangled by her ex-boyfriend, John Thomas Sweeney. He was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and sentenced to 6 years in prison, but was paroled after serving 3.5 years.
How do you serve 3 years when you murdered somebody with your hands?
Yeah, especially when you have 3 names. John Thomas Sweeney. That's the serial killer code, right? The 3 names is usually a serial killer.
I have never heard of that.
Oh.
But also, it's like, why did they let him out on good behavior?
You know, voluntary manslaughter. Yeah, I mean,
he volunteered for manslaughter.
Yeah, he volunteered for it.
The thing is, like, 3 years, like, you couldn't have good behavior enough to make up for killing somebody.
Yeah.
Like, what was it? Well, yeah, but he killed somebody, but he's really funny and nice, so we let him go.
Yeah.
That's not good.
They're like, he knew the girl from Poltergeist.
We left, I guess.
Like, well, wait.
He name dropped? I was thinking about that with the skeletons, too, because I was like, what if you're in a movie and then you never even know it? Like, these people were in movies.
Oh, the skeleton.
Yeah, they could be like, that's my foot.
Yeah. Okay. I need my residual. Why did the skeleton have that voice? That's my foot. So the other 2 cast member deaths, while unfortunate, were not as unpredictable or mysterious. The evil preacher Kane from Poltergeist 2, who was played by Julian Beck. In 1983, Beck had been diagnosed with stomach cancer, which took his life soon after he finished work on the second installment of the series. And the same film was met with further tragedy after Will Sampson, who played Taylor, the Native American shaman, died after undergoing a heart and lung transplant, which had a very slim survival rate. Now, here's the thing about Will Sampson. Will Sampson actually performed an exorcism on the set of Poltergeist.
Right, because he was a real shaman.
Well, yeah, which led a lot of people to believe that he may have not done it right.
Right.
And so all he did was upset more spirits.
Right.
Which added to the curse.
Right. He had the ability to. He was an actual shaman, but I think that he did it without asking anybody, that he just did it. Yeah. And then that probably has something to do with why it didn't work. Because it's like, nobody wanted to participate in it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then that curse went to them.
Yep. So there was a lot of weird mysteries that happened in Poltergeist. You know what's wild? So Spielberg had filmed Twilight Zone, and there was an actual death on Twilight Zone where the helicopter comes down and it killed one of the main characters. Mm-hmm. And you could actually see it in the film.
I don't want to see it.
So you don't. So there was a lot of, you know, Spielberg always had these unfortunate things. But
we believe the stage is cursed. Stage
that's what 19. We're saying. The stage 19 on Paramount. Even the people that work there, right? They called it Paranormal Paramount, which is not very creative. But
no, but it is. If we said that right now, Paranormal Paramount, I'd be like, oh my God, that's the most genius thing I've ever heard.
So what else was filmed on stage 19?
Oh, well, let me
Poltergeist, get... Wings, what else, Edie?
Happy Days.
Happy Days, okay, all right.
Very weird show to be filmed there. There were not very happy days. Okay, so a lot of you guys know that I worked on Paramount for a few years, like 4 years, and I worked on the TV show Glee.
What?
Yeah. Oh. I was a cheerleader on that show for, I think, like 4 seasons. So I was there a good amount of years. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, said all the time, like, watch out for the ghosts. Like, I thought it was kind of more like a joke. But then I would actually talk to people and they're like, oh, yeah, we see shadow people. They always said they would see, like, a man and a woman, shadow person together, shadow people. Mm-hmm. And then they would say that they would hear children laughing. They would, what was the last thing? Oh, people whispering. A lot of people complained of hearing people whispering in, like, their ear. Oh, not man. Just, like, whispering in general, but, like, whispering in their ear, like they could feel it. Yeah. And that was a problem on the set because they'd be like, who's talking? Who's whispering? Can you guys stop? And it was like, it's a ghost.
Oh, man.
I always thought it was a kind of like a joker. They were trying to scare me. But I remember one time, the guy who was in charge of us, Jim, he was in charge of all the cheerleaders, he goes, don't walk back to the set by yourself. And I was like, why? And he's like, because they filmed Poltergeist here, and the spirit of the little girl lives in this stage. And I was like, you're so silly. I thought he was messing with me. But that was all real.
Yeah, it's wild to think that she was starring in a movie where she was trapped in a TV by a spirit, and now she is a spirit haunting.
Trapped in stage 19.
A lot. Yeah, stage 19.
So not only that, like those like things that happen, the stories of what's happened to Glee and Poltergeist are very similar. Like this show had 4 deaths in the main cast, and Glee also had 4 deaths in the main cast. And people will talk about all the time Glee, the curse. The yes. Glee curse that... Not only the cast, there's 4 cast members, but there's also people in the crew that have died that nobody really even knows about. So the first person was Corey Monteith, and he died of a drug overdose. They did a whole episode saying goodbye to him. It was very sad. And then the next person was Mark Salling, and he was convicted. He was charged by his girlfriend for making her do stuff that she didn't want to do.
Okay.
And then later, when they raided his home, they found that he had pictures of children on his computer, like thousands and thousands of pictures. So he was going to be sentenced, and before he could be sentenced, he hung himself at a park.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was weird, because it's like, you have a house, like, wouldn't you like to die in a place that you feel comfortable? And I always felt like he did it at a park to kind of, like, make it public. Like, I'm sorry, guys. This is the apology.
Yeah.
But it's like, if you want to apologize, maybe just go to jail. Like, maybe just serve your sentence.
Well, you know, actors, they like to play out the scenes in parks.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then next was one of the older cast members. She died of Alzheimer's. And then the last person was Naya Rivera, who died recently. When she took a boat out with her child, she rented a boat on Lake Piru. And when she didn't return the boat, they went out looking for her and the boat. And they only found her son on the boat, who was 4 years old. And Naya was nowhere to be found. And her son had said that she got him out of the water when they were swimming, and then she disappeared.
Yeah.
She went into the water. She never came back.
Could have been exhausted.
And they looked for her. They could not find her. They looked for her for several days. Mm. And luckily, they finally found her, and she could be put to rest. But it's just very eerie that this stage is haunted. And thinking about how many shows I've seen, I don't know shows that have had that many deaths.
Yeah.
And then there was two people in the crew.
Yeah.
The first one was I think, assistant or a producer, and she was actually Julia Roberts' sister.
Mm.
And she wrote a 5-page suicide note, and 3 of the pages were talking about Julia Roberts and how evil she is.
Man.
And then she took her own life. And then the last one was Jim, the guy who's in charge of us, who told me about the ghost. He died of a heart attack in his sleep.
Man. It's wild to think that, okay, so obviously the Paramount lot is across the street from the Hollywood Cemetery.
Yeah.
So they are burying a lot of, you know, Hollywood stars who, to be a Hollywood star, to be a star in anything, you have to have a kind of an obsessive type of energy to get to that level.
And you feed off of other people's attention.
Yeah. So it's just like, we've talked about places in Hollywood that are cursed, and it's like, yeah, a lot of people here have that extreme energy.
Right. Because they want the attention. Yeah, they want to be seen. And like, when we say it's across the street from Paramount, it's literally across the street. And a lot of famous people are buried there. Like Judy Garland is buried there.
Yeah.
A lot of people. So...
yeah, it's wild. And it's not the first time I've heard of Hollywood curses.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I had told you one real quick. John Belushi, you know, I don't know if you know John Belushi, died of an overdose at Chateau Marmont, comedic star. He was set to do this movie called The Noble Rot, which was a dramatic film, and it was going to be like his first attempt to do drama and go away from comedy. Well, he ended up dying, but... every star that was given that script afterwards to kind of take over the leading role also passed away. Chris Farley, Phil Hartman. So Hollywood shelved the script saying...
it's cursed.
It's cursed.
That's also where Whitney Houston died. She died at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Yeah. Okay, cool. I think that's all we got to say about that.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, let's keep going. Sean the Sociopath, written by Minnie Burden.
The story I'm going to tell you happened over the course of roughly 5 or 6 years. When I was in college, I met this dude named Sean. He was good-looking, well-spoken, and confident. He was instantly well-liked by most of the people that he met, but was a bit intimidating to me at first due to the fact that he was pretty jacked and didn't speak to me a whole lot in the beginning. Here I was. An 18, going on 19 fat kid with an inferiority complex that made me act out to get attention. I would wear women's clothes to class to get a laugh, or interrupt the professors with a witticism here or a joke there, again for a laugh. I was that kid. The one that people didn't exactly dislike, but weren't too eager to hang out with because I could be a bit much at times. This did nothing to help with my feelings of inadequacy, but I didn't make the connection there until a couple of years later. Sean and I didn't exactly become fast and hard friends, because I got pretty drunk at a party once and he decided instantly that I was annoying. Still, we were civil to each other, as we were in the same department and had a couple of classes together. We kinda hung with different crowds too, even inside the department. Sean had recently been kicked out of boot camp in the military. He told everyone that it was because he had injured himself badly enough that he had been discharged, but that wasn't true. However, we'll get to that part later. Cut to about 3 or 4 months after my first meeting Sean. I had been invited by a mutual friend, Corey, to come to a small get-together at his place where he incidentally was roommates with Sean. I told Corey that I was kind of wary of Sean and felt like he didn't like me, to which he replied that I was right. And that was why he wanted me to come over. He wanted me and Sean to get to know each other better because he was positive we would become friends if we just gave each other a chance. After some more prodding, I finally agreed. When I arrived at Corey's house, there were maybe 3 other people from the department there. It seemed like a pretty chill setting. There was some alcohol being passed around, and I drank a little bit, but I kept my distance from Sean. After a couple hours and quite a few beers, I was starting to feel pretty good. Someone brought out a couple of joints, and those started getting passed around the room. When one of them made its way to me, Sean spoke up. Don't bother passing to him, he said with a mocking laugh. He's a goody-goody. I'm not exactly sure why he said or even thought that. It might have been because I once mentioned in passing that I'd never smoked weed before. Regardless of why he said it, it made me mad that he was making fun of me. So I did what any 19-year-old drunk dude would do. I grabbed the joint and took the biggest hit I could possibly take. This, as anyone who has ever smoked knows, is a huge mistake for a marijuana virgin when quality kush is handed to him. After my coughing fit and all the laughter at my expense had subsided, I looked at Sean challengingly, and he just kind of nodded in my direction before resuming his conversation. Now, no one told me that you shouldn't mix alcohol and weed. Had I stopped there, I would have been fine. However, I continued to drink, which exasperated all the stuff that comes along with being high. By the time I knew I was high, I was starting to get paranoid. I am, or at least was, a bit of a hypochondriac. Dry mouth felt like my tongue was swelling up and my throat was starting to close. The feeling of almost weightlessness that sometimes accompanies being high made me feel like I wasn't anchored to the floor anymore. The time dilation that you experience with weed made me feel like I was literally frozen in time. I started to panic. By this point, everyone else had gone home and it was just me, Sean, and Corey. I explained to Corey that I thought I was allergic to weed because I wasn't feeling right. And oddly enough, Sean asked me to explain what I was feeling. When I did, he walked me through all of it and calmed me down. Once I was calm, he put a controller in my hands and we played video games until I sobered up enough to drive. It was honestly really cool of him, and it was the start of one of the best friendships I ever had. Until it became the worst, most abusive relationship I've ever been in. Over the next year or so, Sean and I became really close. I considered him one of my best friends. Being around him was almost like a drug. He had this way of making you feel like you mattered. I now know that he was a complete sociopath, but you don't really see these signs until it's too late. He harassed me until I started working out with him, which meant I had more energy and confidence in myself. I got into pretty decent shape. I wasn't ripped. I wasn't even what most people would call fit, but I wasn't the fat kid anymore either. He'd come to my house and force me to go out and do stuff. Before I became friends with him, I was kind of a loner and a hermit. We'd go to the lake just to mess around or go hiking in the woods or any number of outdoorsy type activities. For the first time in years, I had confidence in myself and I was actually quite happy. Enter Lisa. Lisa was the love of my life. The one who got away, or rather, the one that I stupidly dumped twice over a 5-year relationship because I was scared. She's not a huge part of the story of Sean, but she plays a role. She had come to my hometown to go to school, and she had a boyfriend back home, but we clicked immediately. I know you're wondering, and no, we didn't hook up or anything while she was with him. She made her intentions toward me clear, and I made it clear that nothing would happen while she was dating someone else. She told me that she had been considering breaking things off with him as he was a bit controlling and rude. The next day, she walked up to me and kissed me full on in the mouth. When I started to push her away, she laughed and said, "I broke up with Jason last night. You're mine now." I smiled back and our relationship began. I apologize for getting into these details that have nothing to do with Sean. It was just an immensely happy time of my life, and I never would have had the confidence to flirt with Lisa in the first place if it weren't for Sean. The next year after Lisa and I got together was rather uneventful. I will admit there were some red flags with Sean that I didn't see or just outright ignored. Looking back on it now, one of the most obvious was that one day I was hanging out with Lisa when Sean showed up. She had always gotten a bad vibe from him, rightly so. So when he showed up, she left to go to class 45 minutes early. Watching her walk away, Sean said, "I could take her from you if I wanted to." I gave him an incredulous look, slightly panicking that this man who called himself my friend might actually want to and be able to sway Lisa to date him instead. He laughed at my expression and added, "Don't worry, I don't want her. She's like a 6 at best. It's perfect for you, but I prefer my thoughts a little thinner and much hotter. Just thought you should know that if I wanted, I could take her from you." It should be noted that Lisa was thin, if curvaceous, and absolutely gorgeous in a very classical way. I'm now convinced that Sean actually was attracted to her, but he saw himself as the alpha and needed to assert his dominance over me, one of his perceived betas. I'm ashamed to admit that it worked. I did get angry and told him not to talk to or about my girlfriend in such a gross manner. But once he gave a half-hearted apology, I just kind of shrugged it off. The next year, there were even more red flags that I chose to ignore. I know the story's moving rather quickly right now, but those first couple of years weren't really that bad. Yes, Sean was starting to show his true colors, but the really horrible moments were still to come. Also, if you're keeping track, I was at a 2-year college for 3 years. That's just how long it took me to get my associate's degree. That's neither here nor there. Sean started dating one of the freshmen in our department. I heard from others that the relationship was incredibly psychologically abusive on his end, and I kept brushing it off because the girl he was dating hadn't spoken up. And Sean was a good guy, right? I mean, I hadn't witnessed it. Other people may just be misinterpreting Sean's unusual sense of humor in a way that painted him in a bad light in their minds. I was unaware at the time that, of course, she wouldn't speak out against him because that's what psychological abuse is. It's gaslighting and insults and ensuring that the victim believes himself to be absolutely worthless and deserving of the treatment that they receive. During the end of year department party, I proposed to Lisa, and she said yes. When Lisa and I graduated from college with an associate's degree, we decided to move to a new school together. Despite the fact that our relationship grew stronger than ever without Sean in our lives, a dot that I didn't connect due to still being firmly in his psychotic grasp, the college we decided to transfer to was absolute garbage. And after the year was over, we had decided to transfer again to a better and cheaper school, this time about an hour away. Coincidentally, it was the same school that Sean now attended. That summer, Lisa moved back to her hometown while transitioning between schools, and I ended things with her for the first time over the phone. Really immature, I know. But we were like 5 hours apart since I had stayed behind to live on the campus and work, and neither of us could find the time to visit the other. The only reason I can logically come up with is that I was scared of the commitment. I've always said that when I marry, I want it to be for life. I got in my head and started to worry about whether or not Lisa was the person I really wanted to spend the rest of my life with. When I moved to the new city, Sean helped me to get an apartment in the same complex where he and Corey, the friend from earlier, both lived. We're in separate buildings, but the apartments were set up in a way that the courtyard between the two buildings was like 40 feet across. I could actually see Sean in his basement apartment window from my second floor, and when we both had our blinds open. There are many times that I would glance out the window while playing video games. Sean would catch my eye and wave me over. So I would obediently turn my game off and head over to his place, smoke a little weed, and watch one of his 4 DVDs for the billionth time. During this time in my life, I became a major alcoholic. I'm fairly certain that Sean realized this was happening, but said nothing because he wanted to be able to hold it over me later. He may have contributed to my alcoholism a bit. He began to use the same bullying tactics he had once employed to get me to work out and go do things. This time, he was using them to get me to go out drinking. If I told him that I had a class early the next day or homework that needed to be done, he would just wave it off and tell me we would be back in plenty of time for me to get my homework done, plenty of sleep. We would often stay out till 2 in the morning when the bars closed, or later if he met someone cool and decided we're going to go to their house to hang. If I said I didn't have money, he would promise to pay for me. At the end of the night, I would get a bill I could barely afford, and he would explain that clearly he meant he would pay for the first couple of rounds, and if I drank more than that, it was my fault. Several times I had to borrow money from him to pay rent, which further put me in his control. I would like to take a brief break and address the elephant in the room. I realized that every single one of the previously mentioned problems stemmed from me. I could have moderated my drinking. I could have told him no when he asked me to go out. I could have realized sooner that he was never truly going to pay my bar tab or that we weren't going to be home early. I take responsibility for all these things. That being said, something you have to understand about Sean is that he would gaslight and make me feel like I was being a bad friend if I told him no, despite having a very valid reason for the refusal. What I'm trying to do by telling you this part is point out that he was never the good friend that I thought he was. Or he would have pointed out that I was drinking too much. Would it have stopped me? As I know now from the numerous attempts by another really true friend, no, it wouldn't have. But at least in hindsight, I would be able to say, you know, Sean tried to get me to stop drinking. He was a good friend. Back to the story. Some few months after moving to the new city, Sean introduced me to a friend of his from out of town, Jennifer. She's a very pretty woman with dyed red hair, styled in a pixie cut. She was thin, with an athletic build and a gorgeous face. She was honestly every straight man's dream. Not only that, but she was intelligent, funny, quick-witted, compassionate, and kind. I instantly developed a crush on her, but I was sure she was out of my league. I asked Sean if she was seeing anyone, though, because at that point I still had some confidence. He told me she wasn't and asked if I liked her. I said yes, and he assured me that he would try to get a feel for what she thought of me. Cut to a few days later, Sean's dating her now. This confused me, because when he introduced us, they kept making jokes about how neither of them were really interested in the other, and they would never work as a couple. I think even back then, I knew that he had done his psychological games to get her to date him so he could once again assert his dominance over me. Shrugged it off, happy that my friend had finally found a girl to make him forget that freshman he had been dating a couple of years ago. He had constantly moaned about missing her when she finally got the courage to tell him to get lost one night after he called her fat, which is maybe 95 pounds. Over the next few weeks, I started to notice that Jen was looking more and more exhausted and haggard. When I asked if she was okay, she would just smile and assure me that her workload was just getting to her. We'd started to become friends, so I asked her to not hesitate in coming to me if there's anything I could help her out with. She thanked me for the kind gesture, but again, she said she would be fine. I would later find out that Sean was treating her just the same as he had treated his previous girlfriend. She apparently told Sean about my offer for help, thinking it was sweet that I wanted to help her, and as you might guess, Sean flew off the handle. I've never seen him so angry. He came to my apartment, banging on the door, fit to break it down, and screaming at me to get my two-faced butt out in the hallway so he could kill me. I didn't know at the time, but Sean had started taking steroids, which explained part of his unfounded rage. After nearly an hour of him pacing my living room, threatening and yelling loud enough to wake the whole neighborhood, I was finally able to convince him that my intentions were nothing but friendly towards Jen. Bro code dictated that even if the two of them broke it off, I wasn't going to pursue her, since she dated one of my best friends. Once he finally believed that I wasn't trying to stuff his girl like a Thanksgiving turkey, as he put it, it was like a switch had flipped. Suddenly we're best friends again, and his earlier rage seemed to have been forgotten, as if none of it happened. He dumped Jen shortly after. My guess is that he realized I had no romantic interest in her, and therefore couldn't use his relationship with her to needle me and control me. I only saw her a handful of times after that. The last time I saw her, she looked so much happier. Yet another sign about Sean that I didn't see or chose to ignore.
Okay, what the heck?
Okay, so this is the beginning.
This isn't a ghost story.
No, I told you, it's a sociopath.
Very, yeah, he's very spooky. He's definitely spooky. We wouldn't know anything about drugs. No. Drugs are bad.
Drugs are bad, guys.
So I couldn't relate to some of it. But it seems like he's just jealous of him. And this is what always happens when two people don't get along and their friend is like, oh, you guys would get along so well. I can't believe you don't like each other. It's because they're the same. And that's why they don't like each other. Because they see things in themselves they don't like through them. And they're like, oh, I don't like that guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's wild. Like when I started reading this first part, I've had friends that done this to me. So I know what this guy's going through, where there is a weird, you think you're friends with you know, another man as a man, and then they become competitive.
Yeah. And also it's like he helped him get in shape. Like he helped him like feel confident in his own skin. So when he's tearing him down or doing weird things, it's like it offsets it because it's like, oh, he gave me the good life that I've always wanted. But then he's also tearing me down or like being vindictive. So it kind of like evens out.
Yeah. So as you see the first part, you see the signs.
Not that spooky though.
Not that spooky, but it gets a little bit worse. Well, it's a let's not meet. It's a,
okay.
It's all about
Does this guy turn into a ghost?
No, you want him to? I can rewrite it.
I'm just messing with you.
Okay, all right.
Let's keep going. Part two.
About a month after the yelling incident, Lisa and I got back together. She's incredibly distrustful and weary of me at this point. Rightly so. I had broken her heart for no other reason than I was an idiot. Over time, she began to trust me with her emotions again. This was a mistake on her part, and I don't mean to sound cruel. Perhaps I picked up some things from Sean. I know I was fairly manipulative. I am more ashamed of that than I can ever portray with words. I hate myself to this day for some of the ways I treated her during our second stint as a couple. Lisa was still uncomfortable around Sean, and she would often leave if we were hanging out and Sean showed up. He never seemed to catch on that she didn't want to be around him. Things were made far worse when we went to a house party one night and Sean groped her. Again, I am incredibly ashamed to admit what I did when she came to me in tears of rage and disgust and told me what happened. I'm ashamed because the first thing out of my mouth was, Sean wouldn't do that. Maybe you just misunderstood what was going on. She practically yelled at me. He smacked my butt and grabbed my chest. I said, all right, I'll go talk to him. I should just cut him out right then and there. I should have taken Lisa home. I should have went and knocked Sean out. I should have done a lot of things, but I've always been a people pleaser, and Sean brought this out of me in the worst way. When I asked Sean about the situation, he told me that he grabbed her waist to get around her in the kitchen, which was crowded, and they had accidentally brushed her chest while reaching for a bottle of rum. I believed him. I went back to Lisa and conveyed what he had told me. After a lot more enraged tears and yelling, she left. Why she just didn't dump my stupid harassment, apologist, victim blaming self right then and there, I still don't know. When Sean appeared a few minutes later and I explained what happened, he put on a faux sympathetic face and said with a chuckle, "Man, forget her. Let's find you a hot drunk chick who wants to forget what happens to her." Even back then, I knew that that was a huge red flag. I do not have sex with drunk women, but I still ignored those signs. I didn't cheat, but I ignored the signs. Lisa didn't speak to me for a week, and she was right to do so. She should have never spoken to me again. For the next few months, things with Sean were a bit strained, and we didn't hang out much. Things with Lisa improved again now that Sean wasn't around. We were even talking about moving in together. This would not have happened before, because I was going to break up with her again before long. I didn't know that I was going to do this at the time, but it was going to happen. When it did happen, there were no tears like the last time. There was no pleading that we could make it work. Lisa simply fixed me with an emotionless, almost dead gaze and said, "My sister told me not to trust you again. I should have listened. Get your crap and get out of my apartment." Now, I really wish that she had just left it at that, but over the next couple of years, we'd go on to have a few stints as friends with benefits, as we both knew what we wanted. But that was all it was. You know, nothing more than that. There was no feelings in it for her. We never got back together. And we became sort of facsimile friends again. Shortly after our breakup, I became immensely depressed. I didn't realize that it was because I was still in love with Lisa. Why would I be? I'd broken things off with her. Regardless, I started drinking even more and stopped working out. I started regaining all the weight that I lost my freshman year of college. Sean noticed, often remarking that I was fat. I never really minded it because I was used to my weight being the butt of every joke. Besides, he had always said it with a laugh to let me know that he was only joking. You know, the way good friends always insult each other, right? At the same time, I started hanging out with him again. One day he came to me asking if I wanted to move in a house with him. I politely declined because I like living alone. My rent was relatively cheap. He called me a punk and got unreasonably angry, saying that I owed him everything. He proceeded to scream at me for half an hour. He didn't speak to me for 3 days, but did eventually calm down. He never apologized for his ridiculous outburst, though. When he moved out, another mutual friend took his apartment after having just gone through a bad breakup, and I started hanging out with his friend, Mark, quite a bit since he was just across the courtyard. During this time, I met a man through Mark who would go on to become one of the two best friends that I ever had. One of the most amazing people I've ever known. Enter Nick. Yeah, Nick. Yeah. Yeah, Nick. Remember the friend from earlier who said I regularly tried to get me out of stop drinking? Well, that's Nick.
I don't even remember that.
That's Nick. He was and is a man who, for some reason, I never want to disappoint. Yeah, you don't want to. Even today, being mostly sober, a huge part of what keeps me from drinking is the idea that if Nick found out, I would be more ashamed of myself than if I publicly pooped my pants in front of the women of my dreams. Personally, that to me is a mark of a true friend, mostly because Nick never asked for or expected me to feel this way. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think he's a little bit uncomfortable with it, but it's not something I can just turn off. Huh. Nick and I hit it off fairly quickly and started hanging out regularly. It was with Nick and his circle of friends, all of whom I proudly now call my friends, that a Dungeons & Dragons group started that lasted for nearly 4 years. Nick plays a bigger, if not huge, part in the story later, okay? Things continued this way for maybe a half a year before I finally decided to take Sean up on his offer and moved into his house with him, mostly because money was tight. His current roommates had moved away for whatever reason, and he had a couple of vacancies. I took one room, and a friend of his from when he was in boot camp, Greg, took the other. For a while, things were awesome. Sean had apparently become Catholic. He was off the juice. It was like I had my old friend back from the days when we first started becoming chummy. He, Greg, and I would often go on road trips, go to bars, or just go to some outdoor attractions around the city and walk around. Now, remember that I said that Sean had been discharged from the military and claimed that it was due to an injury? Turns out that was not true at all. One night, while Sean was at work, Greg and I were hanging out with some beers, and the topic came up. Greg asked, "You know he's crazy, yeah?" I said, what do you mean? He was kicked out before he finished boot camp. Oh, really? He told me that he suffered some kind of injury and that they had to let him go. After I said this, an incredulous look came over Greg's face, and he turned slowly to look at me. He then proceeded to tell me that what Sean had told me was an utter lie. He told me that Sean had had reason to suspect that his then-wife was cheating on him and had been overheard by a commanding officer saying that when he finished with boot camp, he was going to murder them both and the daughter that he and his wife had. He had been given an in-depth psychological evaluation and had been discharged essentially for being too insane for the military. I later confirmed this with some of Sean's childhood friends. At this point, I was starting to realize who Sean really was. Thinking back on some of the interactions I had with him, unfortunately, I was stupidly loyal to someone I perceived to be a good friend.
All right, that sounds like me.
Oh, which one?
Being stupidly loyal to somebody who I think is a good friend.
It happens, you know?
You have to be really crazy to get kicked out of the military.
Yeah, to be too insane for the military.
Yeah, because I know a lot of people who are insane, and they were in the military. Yeah. And I'm like, well, how crazy do you have to be? That means a lot of other people had to report, like, yo, we're not comfortable around this guy. Yeah. He's weird. And that says a lot, because they are weird.
It does say a lot. Yeah, if the military's like, nah.
They don't deny people, usually. Yeah. Because
they took Forrest Gump.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't deny people. You have to be very problematic.
Yeah.
So this guy has a history of being a manipulator.
Yes.
And the army saw it and was like, no, you can't die for us.
Yeah, sorry.
Nah,
no,
we don't want you.
Go live insane off just go, away.
Yeah, live insane. Okay,
so good. So now we know Sean was wanting to murder his kid and his ex-wife.
I'm starting to not like that guy, Sean.
Yeah, good. You see?
It was a lot. There's a lot of characters to this.
Yes.
But that guy, Sean, I don't really trust that guy.
I trust Nick, though.
Yeah, Nick seems like a trustworthy guy. All right, let's keep going.
One of our uglies brought something to my attention. The Waverly Hills Sanitarium in Louisville is under threat of being torn down. It's one of the most haunted places in America. 50,000 people died there. And so if you want to help preserve this historical and very haunted place, you can go sign the petition at SaveWaverlyHills.com. And they are also on TikTok at Save_Waverly_Hills. So go help out. I'm already in. I'm donating $3 a month for a year. Go check it out. Let's save this spooky place.
All right, before we get to the last part of this creepy story.
Yes.
Don't forget to join us on the Facebook group, the Instagram, and the website. And you can send us your story, and we'd love to hear it. We'd love to read it, dissect it, tell you you have a skinwalker. We'd love it.
Yeah, send us stalker stories. We'll talk about your stalkers.
Make them up. We don't care.
There's a few that they send us that are fictional, and I'm actually going to put them in a little.
Really?
Yeah, there's one guy that's been writing stories, and I've been meaning to put it in.
So I'm like a really hot guy, like huge muscles.
Let me start with
and
this.
And a demon girl was trying to get with me. Come join us, do all that. Don't forget to give us 5 stars. It really helps the podcast out. And Nick, where are you going to be?
I'm going to be in El Paso this weekend at the Comic Strip. And then I will be on a cruise again for 2 weeks. Then I'm back, and Edie and I will be going to Texas to go do Laredo, San Antonio, and Austin. Then we're going to do some NorCal shows. And my album's going to be released, my new comedy album, Early Show, Late Show, April
12th, 2022. Where?
It'll be released on all platforms that you can...
Netflix?
Spotify and all that. No.
Comedy
album, man.
Okay. On Spotify and stuff.
Yes.
All right, cool. And they're probably listening to True Scary Stories on Spotify.
Yeah, so you can, when that album comes out, you can listen to, Early Show is the clean half, Late Show is the dirty half.
Yeah, okay, good. I like that. So if you live in Texas or Northern California, come by and see us. We love it. Okay, let's get to it.
Okay, the final part of Sean the Sociopath.
Part 3.
At some point, I had invited Nick to come over and hang out to play video games. And when Sean met Nick, he immediately called him fat. Now, Nick was at the time a large man. He had since made enormous strides in his fitness journey. Shout out to Nick for your hard work. If you're reading this, I am, but not him. You look great. Regardless, I remember the look of utter disbelief on Nick's face. But I defended Sean by saying that was just how he made friends. If he wasn't calling you names, then it meant that he didn't like you. By the way, can we stop that way of thinking? Treating people like trash as a way to break the ice is terrible. I'm guilty of it in the past, and I hate that I used to do it. Anyway, not relevant. I could tell Nick was skeptical, but he just kind of went with it. I think he kind of resented me for not defending him, but he never said so. I don't blame him if he did. A few weeks after the conversation with Greg, Sean had a friend of his from out of town stay with us for the weekend. Greg was out of town for work or something. I forget the details as they are not important. Before this friend of Sean's arrived, he told me that she was fat, but pretty. And if I wanted to dig her down, then I had his blessing. This did not sit well with me, not only because of how he described her, which I learned wasn't true when she arrived, but because he felt the need to give his permission for two of his friends to hook up with each other. I kept my mouth shut, though. I forget the woman's name, but she was a very pretty woman. She was curvaceous, but in no way fat. I was confused as to why Sean would describe her as such. She and I got along really well from the start. That night, she and Sean slept together. Again, I'm fairly certain he slept with her because he could tell I was taking a liking to her. I wasn't falling over myself to get in a relationship with her, but I did like her quite a bit. Sean had to once again assert his dominance. The next day, we all had lunch at a local restaurant, and Sean essentially left his friend and myself to drive his car back to the house while he wandered off to do God knows what. I was infuriated that he would do that. Not necessarily the leave us part, but the fact that his friend had come to town specifically to visit him, and he just bailed on her with no reason. She and I spent the day watching movies and playing video games. We talked quite a bit about Sean, as he was our one common link, and a lot of things came to light about Sean that I won't mention here simply because I don't want to be doing this for the next 2 weeks. I texted Sean multiple times throughout the day, asking where he was. He didn't respond until about midnight when I sent a text telling him it was kind of rude for him to just leave his friend with me when she had come to see him. The text I got back just read, "Mind your business, fatty. I'll be home when I get home." He finally rolled up around 10 the next morning as his friend was getting ready to leave. He was driving a motorcycle that I'd never seen before. He barely said goodbye to the woman as she was leaving, and when the door was shut, I rounded on him. "Where were you, dude?" I demanded, feeling myself getting angrier by the word at what he had done. "Not that it's any of your business, but I was helping a friend bury a body," he shot back as we walked into his room. I knew instantly that this was a lie. I had this intuition when it came to Sean. I could almost always tell when he was lying, and this was just so outlandish that I didn't even need to consider to know it was absolute bull. I said under my breath, "No, you weren't." He said, "What was that, fatty?" coming back into the room shirtless and getting in my face. I gently pushed him away from me, and he looked utterly dumbfounded. He couldn't believe I would ever stand up to him like this. I retorted quickly. I said, "You're lying. But if you want to treat your friends like nothing when they travel 4 hours just to hang out with you for a couple of days, then be my guest." We stood there glaring at each other for a few seconds before he deflated and looked slightly ashamed, which shocked me. He said softly, "I was with a girl I've been dating." I said, my anger rising again, "So you invited a friend to stay with us? Cheated on your girlfriend with her? Bailed on us and then lied to me about it? Screw you." I turned on my heel and stomped up to my room. I'm fairly certain Sean threw something at me, but missed because I heard a thump on the wall just to the left of the doorway as I walked through. I didn't stop to find out. I didn't see or speak to Sean for a couple of days after that. It wasn't until Greg came home from his trip and noticed that we weren't spending time together and were acting coldly toward one another that our friendship started to repair a bit. Most of that was due to Greg yelling at us that he wasn't going to live with a couple of punks who couldn't get their lives together and act like adults. Despite our relationship repairing slightly, things were never really the same after that. Over the next few months, Sean started to sell drugs and always kept a loaded gun in the house. I specifically remember him telling me one day that some guy was going to be coming over to give him some money that he was owed, and if he showed up while Sean was at work, I was supposed to take the money, count it, and put it on his bedroom desk. I didn't know he was dealing at the time, so I assumed it was a guy who owed him money. I just agreed and went back to playing video games as he left for work. Sean got home from work before the guy showed up, and when there was a knock on the door, Sean came out of his bedroom with his gun in hand and held a finger to his lips. He opened the door to reveal a man standing on the porch with a wad of cash in hand. Sean immediately pointed the gun in his face, cocked the hammer back, and started screaming at him to drop the money on the ground and get off his porch. As the dude was fleeing in terror, Sean yelled after him that if he ever saw him again, he would kill him. Of course, I was immediately distressed by what I just witnessed, but I was equally terrified. When he turned to me with a huge grin after collecting the money from the porch and closing the door, I gave him a weak smile and ignored the whole thing. I learned later that he was back on steroids when this happened. During this time, Sean would regularly come home late at night, three sheets to the wind, ranting about one ethnic group or another. The one that sticks out in my mind the most was when he stumbled in so drunk that he could barely string together a coherent thought. He was yelling about globalism and how the Chinese were trying to take over the world. He mumbled a string of words I couldn't make out that shouted clear as day, "Ping Ling," followed by another string of unintelligible grumbling, and finally, "Our daughters." As the last words left his lips, he immediately fell to the floor and began to sob. I had no idea what to do. If I tried to help him, I knew he would get violent toward me. In the end, I did nothing. I just went to my room. A few weeks after this particularly lovely incident, Sean and I got in an argument about something I can't remember. He stormed off to his room and I thought it was over. I knew from experience that given time and distance, he would calm down. He would never apologize, but at least the situation would de-escalate. I was wrong this time. 10 minutes later, he came crashing back into the living room, gun in hand, and pointed it in my face. He was yelling that if I wasn't going to respect him, that he might as well just kill me. I said, far more calmly than I felt, "You're not going to shoot me." Inside, I was sweating bullets, despite the fact that I did honestly believe he wouldn't shoot me. I'd been around guns before, but never had one pointed at me. He said, "Yeah, why do you think that?" I replied, "I know it. I know you're not going to shoot me, because I'm one of the few real friends you have left." He seemed to consider this for a moment and finally lowered the gun. His face was still murder incarnate, but at least the gun wasn't pointed at me. I asked, "Can you move, man? I'm trying to watch Netflix." He continued to stare at me for a long while, seeming to be internally fighting with himself before finally stomping back to his room. I didn't see him again for the rest of the night. A few days later, Sean and Greg asked me to sit down when I came home from my third double in a row from the restaurant I worked at. I asked why, and they said we needed to talk about me living there. I told them there was no need, I was moving out. They seemed satisfied with this. I went to my room to get so much needed sleep. As a side note, as I was moving out, I accidentally broke the handle off the storm door, and Sean lost his mind, screaming at me and calling me all kinds of names, including the N-word. I assured him that I would replace it, but he just kept calling me names. Nick was helping me move out at the time, and once we were away from the house, he gave me a look that spoke volumes. "I know," I said, "I know. Part of the reason I'm moving out." Nick replied, I didn't say anything. I said, "You didn't have to." This was the point that I finally snapped and realized that Sean was nothing but a toxic piece of garbage. It took someone I hadn't known for a very long time giving me a single look for the puzzle piece to finally fall into place and go, forget all this. After I moved out, I only saw Sean once more. I was coming out of class on the university campus. He drove up on his motorcycle and started trying to make conversation, but I just made some lame excuse about needing to get to work or home or something. About a year later, I blocked Sean completely on all social media when he commented on a Facebook and called my mom the C word. I don't know why I didn't do it sooner. About a year after that, Nick and I were at the mall. Being on a bit of a time crunch and needing things from different stores, we decided to head different directions and meet up in the food court. I finished what I needed to do first and was standing in front of Dairy Queen waiting for Nick to meet me when I got a call from him. "What's up?" I said, by the way of answering. "I just saw Sean," he said without preamble. "He's going into the store I was coming out of." He didn't need to tell me which Sean. He knew most of the worst of what I put in his story by this point, although I'm sure some of these anecdotes would even surprise him. My heart seemed to seize and I couldn't breathe. I hadn't seen or spoken to Sean over 2 years, and the thought of coming face to face with him now filled me with dread. "Hello, you there?" "Yeah," I said, finally finding my voice. "I'll meet you at the car." "That's why I told you I'll be out in a bit." I practically sprinted to the car and just kept praying to whatever gods might exist that Nick would be out soon. I went over and over in my mind what I would say to Sean. Luckily, I never had to find out what I would have actually done, because Nick appeared pretty quickly. That was the last I heard of Sean. The incidents that are portrayed in this are not everything that happened over the course of my relationship with Sean. There were more, including more death threats, physical altercation, more name-calling, and insurance fraud that Sean decided to rope me into without my knowledge. These were just the worst or more poignant incidents that need to be told. Were I to tell the entire story would be a whole novel. A lot of things, while terrible, isn't really all that relevant in the grand scheme. So, that's the story of Sean. Now I know at this point you're wondering yourself, why didn't I just leave Sean in the dust a long time ago? Why didn't I walk away from the friendship at the first sign of trouble? There are a few reasons. First and foremost, as I said, Sean was a sociopath. Sociopaths are extremely versed in making people trust him, even treat them like trash. Not to mention he gaslit me and made me feel as though a lot of smaller incidents were my fault. That in turn led to me believing the bigger problems were my fault. This is how psychological abusers keep control. Secondly, I'm a loyal friend to a fault. I will see the best in people I care about even if they stab me in the back. It's a fault of my own that I'm working on. I only saw the terrible in Sean when he treated another friend I was loyal to terribly. Third, a part of me was terrified to walk away. There was a piece of me that was scared, and sometimes still is since I blocked him, they would get in his head to kill me because I rejected him. It's again part of the conditioning that abusers do. Regardless, I'm much happier now and glad the whole ordeal is behind me. I'd like to end on this final note. If you're in a relationship of any kind where you're starting to see red flags, don't ignore them like I did. I explained away a lot that Sean was waving proudly all these red flags and I regret it to this day. I was lucky and got out of the most toxic friendship I've ever known. If you need help getting out, seek it immediately. Leave everything behind if you have to. Things can be replaced. You can't. Anyway, thanks for listening. And Sean, please stay wherever you move to. I don't ever want to see or hear from you again.
Oh, man. So his friend was just, like, not a good guy.
Not a good guy.
I thought he was going to turn into a ghost or something.
Oh, okay.
His friend just...
Last I heard of Sean, Sean turned into a ghost, but he did it without dying. He just is haunting me.
He, like, makes people have sleep paralysis at the same time.
Yeah.
There he is. Yeah, it's kind of really sucky because he was in, like, a toxic, abusive friendship. Relationship, but it wasn't even his partner. It was just a friend.
You know, and there are some friends that can be that bad, you know, and you don't know it because, yeah, you're like, you're just a friend, you know? Like, it's such a weird, different relationship.
I think the scariest part of this story was how much people don't like fat people. Like, why does that keep coming up? They kept mentioning that. Like, oh, she was fat, he was fat, like...
You know, people say that.
I never think about that, but, like, why is it... I guess because he thinks he is, so well, it's on his head.
I'll give you a quick anecdote. One time I was at the Comedy Works bathroom, sitting on the toilet, number two, right? And somebody walked into the bathroom, and, you know, of course it smelled. And he was like, oh, come on, fatty, flush the toilet. And there I am, you know, skinny as
like
I am.
120 pounds.
Yeah, and I'm just like, oh, people just say that. He doesn't even know who's
in
here.
I don't hear it that often, but I heard it so much in the story.
Yeah, well, Sean.
I heard it a lot. But I also think the guy who's telling the story, I don't know if I necessarily trust him either.
Yeah.
He seems like he's trying to get attention or something, like trying to get people's trying to get people to feel bad for him.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to hear Sean's side of the story.
Oh yeah, that guy? Yeah. Oh man, yeah, he was like, a dork.
I mean, I pulled a gun on him.
Yeah.
But he was fat. Like, come on, guys, he was fat. Yeah, and then I'm surprised this was him holding back. He's like, oh yeah, there's a lot of other details. I'm like, oh man, I thought this he's like, it would be a novel. I'm like, this was you holding back?
Yeah.
You told us everything.
He told us
about
everything.
I could have done this story in one sentence.
Yeah.
My friend was jealous of me. He pulled a gun on me.
There you go.
I'm fat.
Well, two sentences. And
I'm fat.
All Nicks are great people.
Yeah, that's exactly. Nick was a good part of this story.
That's the whole reason I read the story.
It was taxing. All right, guys, we love you. Thank you so much for listening to this. Watch out for Sean's. There's Sean's in the world. You got to watch out. Find yourself a Nick. All right, guys, we love you. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Bye.